And thanks for tuning in to Valley Free Radio. It is out there. It's Tuesday, July 14th, 2020. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Out There airs every Tuesday from 3 until 4 here on Valley Free Radio. And you can hear archived editions of Out There at weatherbeard.com/out there. Wow, that was some kind of storm today that blew in the midday. It turned the bike lane on South Street into a river. I had to ditch my bike there. And then when I was picking up trash, and then if I dropped something, like a piece of recycling, when I was trying to empty it. Now, usually if I drop something on the ground, I can pick it up. If it's a windy day, the wind might blow it away. But today, if I drop something, the floodwaters carried it on the way down South Street, and I had to run splashing after it. But I'm very grateful I did not get struck by lightning, or hear of anyone else who did either. Of course, the news is not all in yet. Anyway, for today's show on Out There, I have an interview with Haya Grossberg, who is author of Freedom from Psychiatric Drugs, and also have a little clip from Jean, who I ran into. So I was coming back from Valley Recycling today. Actually, I was coming back from the old Trolley Line Conservation Area in East Hampton looking for blackberries. They're starting to turn red. I think in 2 weeks it'll be time to go back and pick them. Anyway, then I got to the skate park and was going to eat the black raspberries under the white mulberry tree there. And I saw someone dribbling a basketball on the basketball court. Do you know how exciting that was? Because they took the hoops down when COVID started. And so it's been like nobody on the lonely courts. And to see someone playing, I was like, I'll have you know, I walked away from the raspberries. I did not even eat the raspberries. I was like, I got to play basketball. And as I got close, I saw it was Jean. Bouncing. That's playing. So Jean, we were just talking, and I was asking Jean what he was up to.
Basically, I've been working on this thing that's looking at COVID, right? We're lucky in the U.S. where we have access to infrastructure, basically, you know, internet, Wi-Fi, at least a lot of us do. And so we can imagine working from home, going to school, right, online, mm-hmm. and all that. But in a lot of places around the world, people don't have access to those basic infrastructures. So all of a sudden, when the schools are shut down because of COVID, or even if they then potentially don't work, they have to go back home, and home doesn't have all of that. So they can't do what we're doing, yeah. which is to say work from home, study from home. So I guess I've been working and thinking about those kind of problems where the digital divide becomes an even greater divide because of natural pandemics or unnatural pandemics, mm-hmm. however you want to look at it, yeah. and how it affects people.
Yeah, you were talking about universities in Haiti where one of the problems is access to computers for online classes or access to all that infrastructure. And then another issue is the public health part of it with depression.
Right. So if you imagine, in some cases, what some teachers or schools do is they say, okay, well, we don't have access to computers and all that, but we still want you to learn your stuff. So why don't you study or read X, Y, and Z chapters, and we're going to give you homework, and you're going to, there's a local church that's a drop-off site or something like that. You can drop off your homework at whatever designated spot, uh-huh. and so, you can pick up. And so essentially, they find a way to keep things going, uh-huh. at least they try. Uh-huh. But what a lot of people are finding is that people are too depressed to even do the homework. And so essentially, your grade curve is not looking so good. And so you, as a director of the school, university, you just come to the conclusion that, you know, I think we should just let this year go because we can't fail everybody. And why are they depressed? Well, they're depressed because they're at home and they're used to sort of a traditional style of learning where they're in the classroom and there's somebody teaching at them or that whole context. So that's what they're used to. And the pressures of you know, family life and also just the distractions of being in a country where, I don't know, more than 50% is unemployed. So all these distractions weigh on you heavier. Perhaps if you're in a classroom, you could, you know, your teacher could command your attention, mm-hmm. and or your friends could motivate you to pay attention or to get that work done or have a study group. But when you don't have that as a mental health support basis, you are on your own and it's much harder.
Yeah.
So that's a mental health piece. So you've got the digital divide where people don't have access to infrastructure, and then you've got the fact that because they don't have it, then there's a mental health piece, and then there's the fact that people have COVID at times. Mm-hmm. And how do they deal with that when it does happen? You know, in a lot of cases, people are drinking teas and herbal remedies, and from what I've heard, that's working out okay for some people. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's also the natural reality that people die.
Talking about depression.
Yeah. But would you believe probably the most depressing thing is not COVID in of itself? It's actually the fact that all the ports in the country are closed. And so if you had an economy that relied on internal imports or on tourism, mm-hmm. Basically that economy is like dwindling down. Just the more and more that those ports are closed. And the catch-22 is if you open up the ports and then you let everything in, yeah. and then you essentially, your cases go up. So you can either suffer from the mental health of not having a bustling economy. As a result, by the way, the prices of all your goods, rice, milk, and everything goes up. So it makes every life more expensive. That actually is the reason why more people are depressed, is because, oh my God, milk costs 5 times more. Uh-huh. Bread costs 3-5 times more. So that's more depressing than COVID itself, in the sense that for a lot of people, it's just the economy.
Can I ask you about your family? Like, how's your family there doing?
My sister's asking for money, naturally. But in general, she's fine. Mental health-wise, I think, you know, I'm trying to be as supportive as I can. Everybody else is doing okay.
Thanks for sharing.
Yeah.
If anything else comes to mind, let me know.
That is early.
You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. That was the interview with my friend John, who lives here in Northampton. I'm grateful to him for sharing. He was a little bit nervous. I had to make him quit dribbling the basketball when we were talking, because I think that was his nerve calming, his mental health prescription for calming the nerves is dribbling that basketball. I understand. So next on Out There, I have an interview with Haya Grossberg, author of Freedom from Psychiatric Drugs. And this interview is from, you know what? I think I say that in the very beginning. I'm here with Haya Grossberg in the backyard of the Bike Lab here in Northampton on Northern Ave. And Haya, thanks for coming over today.
Thank you, Ruthie. It's great to see you.
From your Amherst home. Haya is author of Freedom from Psychiatric Drugs. This book, when was this published?
It was published in December 2018.
And how long were you working on it?
Probably about 10 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did you come to be interested in this topic?
Well, you know, I had my own experiences when I was in my early 20s with being put on psychiatric drugs and having them really ruin my health and nearly kill me. And then I got involved with the Freedom Center in Northampton, which was a group of psychiatric survivors and activists. And I started writing my own story right around that time. I think in large part because I felt like I needed to tell the story that I went through in my own words rather than having had it been told for me by family members or friends or psychiatrists and so forth. And then I've been really passionate ever since then about helping other people to find their own language for their experiences, as well as have their own options, have as many options as possible for coming off psychiatric drugs if they want to.
Uh-huh. When you were on psychiatric drugs, or when you were coming off, like, where were you in terms of, like, career or schooling? Or, like, did you see yourself becoming an author or doing this kind of work?
That's a great question. I was in the middle of school in college, so I had taken some time off from college when I was going through all of that, and I had always been a writer, and so, yeah, I feel like, in a way, since I was at that age of being in college, it really shaped my entire life and my entire career. I had already wanted to be a writer and a teacher and things like that, but I don't think that I had a very clear path of, like, what kind of writer or what kind of teacher I wanted to be before that all happened.
What are you doing now?
Well, I currently consult with people who are coming off psychiatric drugs. I work with individuals and families. Mostly I do work by phone, and I do a lot of writing and blogging, so people find me from all around the world, really. Mm. And I also have been, right before the pandemic, before COVID, I was doing a lot of book talks here in the Pioneer Valley in Western Mass, in Western Massachusetts. So because of the pandemic, I haven't been able to do any more live book events, but I'm hoping that maybe at some point I'll be able to do an outdoor, distanced, small book event. So if anyone out there would be interested in that, definitely let me know. Cool.
So off the top of my head, I'm thinking about how if someone's prescribed psychiatric drugs, maybe insurance would cover that or help cover that. But if they're trying to get off psychiatric drugs, are they economically on their own?
That's a great question. And yes, a lot of times people are on their own economically if they want alternatives to psychiatric drugs, because insurances don't cover most alternatives in most cases. And insurances definitely don't cover things like my services in terms of helping people get off. There are probably a few doctors and psychiatrists out there who do take insurance and help people get off. But, you know, like I said, I work with people around the country and around the world, and most people I know don't have a psychiatrist who knows how to help them get off.
Yeah. So Chipmunk, we're having an interview here.
So a lot of things that can also help people get off psychiatric drugs, like different modalities and treatments and supplements and herbs and things like that, are often not covered by insurance. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about what it might be like to come off of psychiatric drugs? Give an example.
Yeah, definitely. I can talk from my own experience and from a lot of people that I've worked with over the years that in many cases it's really difficult. And people often have to taper pretty slowly, because if you just go right off, which honestly I didn't know, because when I was going through this, it was really before there were a lot of internet forums, or really any internet forums. So I didn't have much information about the need to taper slowly. And often when people take pharmaceuticals, they can just stop taking them if it's not a psychiatric drug or like an opiate or something that creates dependency. But in terms of most psychiatric drugs, it can take a while to taper off, and it has to be done pretty slowly, and people experience usually withdrawal symptoms, which could be like akathisia, which is feeling like you just have to keep moving, like walking in circles. That can also be a side effect of psychiatric drugs. But also people often experience extreme anxiety, insomnia, and often like physical symptoms, maybe like dizziness or kind of like brain fog, disorientation, even things that could be considered extreme psychosis can occur when people are withdrawing. So it's important for people to know that these are withdrawal symptoms. They don't necessarily mean anything intrinsic about that person. They're withdrawal. Like if somebody was withdrawing from any other dependency creating substance.
So coming off of psychiatric drugs can be really a challenge. What are some of the reasons people would want to go that route?
There are a lot of reasons why people want to come off. One is the adverse effects of psychiatric drugs are often really difficult for people. It can cause like a loss of sex drive, loss of sexual function, inability to think clearly, extreme weight gain for some people, diabetes. There's a whole bunch of different things that happen, especially when people have been on psychiatric drugs for a long time. And many, many, many people want to come off of them. I mean, I get emails from people all the time who want to come off of them. So I'm not sure how much the general population knows that there are these you know, thousands and thousands of people who are really wanting to come off of psychiatric drugs. It's very common. Another reason is sometimes people just want to feel like they're just themselves without having to take a drug every day, or, you know, like, taking a drug every day sometimes makes people not know, like, who they really are, if this is themselves, or, like, if their emotions or experiences are being caused by the drug. So it can create almost, like, identity issues where people really want to just know who they are without it.
Yeah. So can you, like, kind of, like, walk us through, like, if someone contacts you, and then how do you sort of walk someone through that?
That's a good question. So often, first I'll, you know, ask them questions, and they'll tell me what their situation is, like how long they've been on the drug, what caused them to go on it in the first place, what was going on in their life then, and what's going on in their life now. So then we look at, like, well, what's going on in their life now, and what kind of supports and situations do they need in place in order to go through the process? So some people that contact me are not even really quite ready to start the process of withdrawal, but they want to prepare for it by making sure they have enough support and enough good, like, lifestyle routines that will help them once they're withdrawing and afterwards. Some people contact me when they're already in the middle of withdrawal, and then it's more about supporting them and helping them to find, again, lifestyle routines and support that will help them to do it successfully, and also to create a taper plan. So a lot of the time people also need and want a witness and validation for what they're going through, because a lot of times doctors and even family members and friends might not be able to recognize what someone's going through with psychiatric drugs and withdrawal. And a lot of times people who contact me really don't identify with a mental health diagnosis, although some definitely do, but some don't at all. And they really are also needing a witness and validation for their own experience of who they are, rather than other people's labels on them, which could be a mental health diagnosis.
Can you share any more about your personal experience and what that was like?
Sure.
I haven't read your book. Maybe it's out there in the book.
Yeah, it's definitely in the book. Do you have a specific question, or?
I guess just wondering about when you were trying to come off, what kind of support did you have? Did you have, like, family that was supportive or not?
My family was supportive once I decided that I definitely wanted to come off. Mm-hmm. I think that when I was going through this, when I was going through it, it was around 2000, 2001. So this was a pretty early phase of like psychiatric drugs being mass prescribed. It was kind of new for them to be kind of being prescribed to more and more, like, the average person versus a smaller percentage of what might be considered extreme cases. So
That was like when the ADHD and all that, Ritalin and all, was that when that kind of boomed?
Yeah, I would say that's when that boomed. And like earlier than that, in the 90s, it was more, the stimulants like Ritalin boomed around then, and earlier than that in the 90s it was maybe more like Prozac and all the SSRIs that were really trending.
SSRIs,
like antidepressants, like Prozac or Zoloft, Paxil, things like that. And another drug that has major issues that was also being prescribed a lot at that time, more to middle-aged people than teenagers, I'd say, were benzodiazepines like Xanax and Ativan and Klonopin, things like that.
I didn't realize Sunday afternoons were the time to fly your airplane. Anyway, so you were given a list of the drugs.
So benzodiazepines. And I personally had an experience with those where I was put on a benzo Xanax. And those create dependency very quickly. So after like a week or two, they're very hard to get off of. At least they cause extreme withdrawal effects. I think after a week or two, someone can definitely get off of it, but they still need to be careful.
Just like a week or two. That's so quick.
Yeah. And doctors at that time really didn't warn people at all about it. They still sometimes don't. But at that time, there were really no warnings to people about these drugs being hard to get off of. I think maybe at that time, doctors maybe didn't even know, that they were so hard to get off of, because they had never even gone through that process of helping somebody get off. So Yeah, so in terms of my own experiences, I did have, like, once I decided definitely that I was going to get off of these, I did have family support. But before that, I was put on 7 different drugs. And when I first got put on them, I actually did not want them. I was forced onto them. And then they really made me apathetic, and they disabled my brain to a very large degree, such that I no longer knew what was going on. Mm. And I became so apathetic that I kind of allowed them to keep putting me on more things, and I didn't understand what was happening. Like, I didn't have the sort of discernment abilities that I had had before that, to know that I didn't want to be on them. Uh-huh. And to know that I didn't identify with the diagnoses. I think once I was on them, I started to actually think that I was mentally ill, because the drugs were making me so unable to think or function. Uh-huh. I started to identify with that diagnosis. Uh-huh. But I think for myself, I had certain, like, dreams and visions and spiritual experiences that, like, guided me to know that I needed to get off of them. And I think that once I got that clarity, I was able to I was lucky, you know, that I had the support to get through it, and that I think the conviction enabled me to, like, knowing. And that's something I do notice with other people as well, with my clients and other people I've known and worked with, is that it's important if somebody wants to get off of them that they have, like, 100% conviction that they want to, because mm-hmm. otherwise it's very easy
yeah.
for doctors and other people to convince them that it's not the right thing to do.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that seems super challenging to try and make a decision to get off of them when your brain is so clouded by them at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially because I think at that time there was very little information available. Now there's so much information available on the internet, so people really can do a lot of their own research. But of course, they have to know how to make sense of all the research, because on the internet you can find every single yeah. possible perspective, right. and some of it is sponsored by the pharmaceutical industries, and some of it is just all different people telling their own experiences. So, and it can be hard to tell, because the pharmaceutical companies also sponsor, you know, quote unquote grassroots groups, and uh-huh. and then those groups use pharmaceutical company party lines because they're being paid to do so.
You're listening to an interview with Haya Grossberg, author of Freedom from Psychiatric Drugs. This is Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ LP 103.3 FM in Northampton. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. I've got more from that interview coming up, but first we're going to hear a little song from Ben Ross, local musician.
Down you go, it's summer but you don't feel bright. You're still waiting for real life. It's hard to know just when your life is going to be right, so you can pay yourself some mind. Oh, how quick the sunrise would kill me if I couldn't send the sunrise out of myself every day. That's what women would say, and can I believe him for once? Help me now, I'm drowning in this town, oh, I'm dead. And I need some love. Met this peaceful looking cows running round the mountains all over here. So why am I still in tears? Oh, how quick the sunrise would kill me if I couldn't send the sunrise out of myself every day. That's what women would say, and can I believe him for once? Thank you. What's up with this shaft of light that's coming past my eye? As I'm going out of my mind, just talking to you, girl, I felt like I wasn't murdering myself for a while, and that's pretty nice. Oh, how quick the sunrise would kill me if I couldn't send the sunrise out of myself every day. That's what Walt Whitman would say, and I believe him for once.
Thank you, Ben Ross. Ben and Haya are both potluck guests at our Monday night potluck at 8 High Street. So back to the interview with Haya, Haya Grossberg. That's with a C-H, in case you're looking for Haya's website, which is HayaGrossberg.com. Haya is author of Freedom from Psychiatric Drugs. And thanks for listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio.
So with COVID, there's a lot of people, it's a very stressful time for people, and a lot of depression and things like that. Do you have advice for people who are having a really hard time right now?
That's a great question. I know that, you know, when COVID first started, when the pandemic and the lockdown first started, there was a huge surge in people going on psychiatric drugs. I read recently that it's gone back to normal, but like gone back to pre-COVID times in terms of the number of people. But I don't really believe that because, again, oftentimes when people get put on psychiatric drugs, there's not really a plan to get off.
Yeah.
So even if the idea is that they'll get off, there's not usually, it doesn't usually happen unless the person advocates for themselves. But what I would recommend, I think what I would recommend really depends on the person, because people have different levels of anxiety about the virus itself and different levels of vulnerability to the virus itself, as well as different levels of vulnerability to isolation or suicidality. Like, suicides have gone up a lot because people are so isolated and despairing. So I think that what I would suggest, and what I've done myself, is to spend as much time as you can in nature and to really stay connected to other people as much as possible. Like, if you have the access and you feel comfortable and safe with it, to spend time with other people outside and to take breaks from like the internet and the computer and everything, because I think that if people are getting all of their connection on the phone or on the screen or on the computer, that gets really stressful and can be very isolating. But again, you know, some people really don't feel safe being in person with others, even outside. So I think it really varies depending on the person. But I did write a blog actually about a lot of different ideas for how people can like help themselves feel better during this time. So I can link to that. But one other thought I had about that was, it really also depends a lot for people, I think, where they live and what they have access to. Mm-hmm. Like, people living in a really big city might not have access to even going outside at times. I know that I know people in New York City that just really were shut in completely for quite a while and maybe still are. So it's really, like, I think on a case-by-case basis. I definitely think that those of us who live in places where we have access to nature and a less dense population have it better. So, you know, if it were me and I was living in a big city, I'd probably just try to find my way out of the big city if I could. But I know that that's not an option for everyone. So,
Can you link to your blog? Or just can you say what it is if people want to look it up on the internet?
Oh, yeah. Well, my website is HayaGrossberg.com. So it's C-H-A-Y-A-G-R-O-S-S. BERG.com, And then I can't remember the name of that blog, but I will share a link to it. Yeah.
Thanks. I think I heard something on Madness Radio recently. So Madness Radio comes on right after Out There.
Yeah.
And so often after I do my show.
I was a guest on there way, way back, like right after I came off psychiatric drugs in around 2003.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, so sometimes listen to the Madness Radio shows, or at least the first part of them. And I think one that I heard not too long ago was talking about how you know, one's economic situation, you know, affects the mental health situation and the and psychiatric diagnoses. And I think specifically it was talking about, like, depression and financial stresses. So, I don't know, I guess I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on how the environment or situations that people are in affect mental health.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I definitely think that finances have a huge effect, or resources, you know, finances and or resources. Another thing I was going to say about current times with COVID is that I think that if you have any way of applying for pandemic unemployment, you should do so, because there are a lot of ways to get it, as and you don't have to have had a regular job in order to get it. And that has been a way that a lot of unemployed people or underemployed people have been able to access more finances in this time. But going back to your question about how resources and finances affect people's state of mind or emotions, I think that's huge. I mean, there have been done studies where people were given a basic income, and that's had such a huge effect on their emotions and their state of mind. And it's almost ridiculous to think that it's possible that it wouldn't, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's almost ridiculous to give somebody drugs if they're struggling with poverty rather than helping them to have more of their basic needs met.
Yeah.
So I think that in terms of all of that, there are also a lot of resources, and also the ability to access them really can sometimes depend on how much somebody already has access to.
Right.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think about that in Northampton, because there's like so many skilled social worker types who, I'm specifically thinking about once before Romney Care, before I had health insurance, when I ended up going to the emergency room for like a day and a half, and then I had these huge medical bills that I was like, what am I supposed to do? But there was a social worker who worked at the hospital, Philly Dick, and she hooked me up. And I was like, I would have never known how to navigate that. And many other places, I mean, it was just, it's like there's such a wealth of knowledge here to help people access resources. It's huge.
Yeah.
So I'm also kind of wondering, in terms of psychiatric drugs and prescriptions, in terms of getting disability, does having a prescription from a psychiatrist enable you to get disability? Do you have to fulfill that prescription to continue to get disability? Can you speak to that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that from what I've noticed and experienced, the ability to get on disability has become way harder in the past decade. I personally was on disability when I was going through all of those things, and then I had gotten off of it at a certain point, and I actually had tried to get back on it at a certain point, and it was impossible. Like, I couldn't. And I wasn't ready. I wasn't going to get on any drugs no matter what. But I do know other people who have to pretend that they're on psychiatric drugs in order to stay on disability. I think it depends, you know, on somebody's doctor. It's easier to stay on disability than to get on it, you know. Right now, it's very hard to get on disability for anything. It's extremely hard. Like, almost everybody gets rejected the first two times and has to go to court and so forth in order to get on disability for anything, really, whether it's physical or mental health. But I think it was easier 10 years ago and earlier. So if somebody's already on it, it does depend on the doctor somebody has. I think if somebody is already on it and they have a doctor who will advocate for them to stay on it, who doesn't care if they're on drugs or not, then it might not matter.
Yeah.
But some doctors might have the fear that if somebody's not on drugs, that the doctor themselves could become liable and get in trouble. So that's another major issue, is that a lot of doctors will take what they consider to be the conservative route of putting somebody on drugs or keeping them on them, because they might be less likely to get into trouble or get sued for that than for helping somebody get off or not get on in the first place. Even though in a lot of cases, psychiatric drugs cause more damage and can be more dangerous than not going on them. But the medical system doesn't necessarily recognize that.
Are there...
You're listening to an interview with Haya Grossberg, author of Freedom from Psychiatric Drugs and Valley Resident. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. This is Out There on Valley Free Radio. Thanks for listening.
Are there some situations where you feel like psychiatric drugs are helpful?
I've definitely known people who have liked the effects of psychiatric drugs and liked the effects that they've had on them and on their life, for sure. That's not a super uncommon thing. So I would say that psychiatric drugs always cause harm if they're taken long term. That's kind of a fact. It's not my opinion, or it's not really an opinion. It's a fact that they do cause harm on the body. So I think, you know, like a lot of things, there can be a harm reduction approach. So there can be cases where a psychiatric drug might be able to, like, interrupt somebody's insomnia or interrupt somebody's extreme type of emotional or mental experience and maybe give them, like, a break from it. So that can be a way that it could be of benefit. I think a lot of times the benefits occur from the social impact because they alleviate people's anxiety. Like, if somebody knows that somebody is on a psychiatric drug, like if their community knows they're on a drug, sometimes that alleviates their anxiety because they have the idea that somebody should be on a drug. Mm-hmm. So sometimes alleviating that anxiety can help. Like, it's almost like a placebo effect. And also, I think they can help sometimes people by the placebo effect. So it's complicated. I think that, you know, in terms of benzodiazepines, if they're only taken like for 1 or 2 days, they can sometimes really help somebody sleep. But there are safer ways to help somebody sleep that don't cause dependence. So it's a little tricky. I think for some people who know how to make sure they're like only taking a benzodiazepine for 1 or 2 days and really not beyond that, then they know how to use the drug in a way that's safe for them and that, like, they only use it in an emergency. Like, I know some people that will only take it maybe if they're traveling and they're having major insomnia and they really need to sleep that one night. So, yeah, I think there are a variety of ways where, you know, any dangerous or harmful substance could, there are cases where it can be helpful for whatever reason. So I do think that there are those for sure.
All right, here's a chapter entitled Turning Trauma into Medicine. Can you say something about that?
Yeah, I think that that is something that, you know, a lot of people experience. A lot of people who have, let's say, a certain kind of a mission in life, or who have experienced a lot of trauma, or both, have often some kind of crisis when they're in their early adulthood. It's pretty common. And, you know, most, there are a lot of cultures that almost like expect that to happen and have rituals and supports in place for people at that age to go through those things and maybe learn from them. And it's almost like an initiation period for a lot of people that feel like they have a really strong purpose or mission in life, and or who've gone through a lot of trauma. So it could be about healing their own trauma, but also about healing something in the world that's also connected to that trauma, like other, like helping other people who have gone through something similar. So I think if people have enough support and the right circumstances, it is very possible to turn whatever trauma they've gone through into something they can offer to others and help people in, you know, in the world at large or in their own community to, who are also going through that. And in a way, it's connected with mentorship and things that our society doesn't necessarily have set up very well for a lot of young adults, but some people get lucky or maybe are in circumstances where they can have enough mentorship and good optimal experiences that they're able to turn their trauma into medicine or an offering for others who have gone through something similar and then be there for those people. I know that I've experienced that. And another thing I just want to say is that all of my clients, everyone that I've ever worked with and known over the years who's gone through psychiatric drug withdrawal, almost, I should say almost, there are exceptions, but almost everyone really would like to use their experiences to help other people who are going through it.
Yeah.
It's like, it's almost a universal thing. So that's really what's meant by turning trauma into medicine, is that people who have gone through a traumatic experience almost always want to use it to help others who have gone through something similar. I just want to say one other thing about this book, because I just noticed as you were flipping through, and I often forget to mention this, but this book that I wrote, Freedom from Psychiatric Drugs, is also a workbook. So it has like a section at the end of each chapter with questions and space for the reader, you or whoever's reading it, to share your own story and explore your own ideas around all of the topics in it, which I think is important because all of the information and content in the book is really dynamic, and it's meant to inspire you to explore what it means for you and your own experiences.
Who's Leonard Roy Frank?
Leonard Roy Frank, he is a psychiatric survivor who has passed on. Let's see, I guess if he were alive, he would probably be, I'd say, in his 80s right now. So he went through electroshock when he was a young adult, and he was forced to have a lot of electroshock, which was a lot more common for people to be forced to have electroshock in those days. I guess it would have been maybe in the, I don't know, 50s, 60s, maybe. I can't quite remember, but like exactly when he had it, maybe even 70s or 80s. But he had major brain damage from the electroshock, and it caused him to basically lose almost all of his memory. So when after that happened, he ended up doing a lot of things to reestablish his mental abilities and his memory. And one of the things he did was collect quotations. So when I met him in like the mid-2000s, probably around 2005 or 6, mm-hmm. he was living in a rent-controlled apartment in San Francisco where he had lived, I think he must have lived there for 40 or 50 years, his whole mm-hmm. adult life, basically. And when he first moved there, I think that's when he started it, he was collecting quotations. So it was kind of like a thing that he was doing to regain his own mental capacities. So he was like organizing on his computer all the quotations that he found that he liked. Mm-hmm. And he ended up actually publishing a quotationary with Webster. So you can find it, Leonard Roy Frank. And he also did a ton of writing. He did a lot of grassroots writing for like street newspapers and things like that. So yeah, he was kind of a hermit, mystic type of person. I definitely felt when I met him that he was a very holy, mystical person that was living a sort of monastic lifestyle. Mm-hmm. But he was also like the type where anybody who could contact him, and he would just say, yeah, come meet me at this cafe. And like, so when I went to San Francisco, I had contacted him because my friend recommended that I contact him, and we just met at a cafe, and he invited me to his apartment, and we chatted for the whole afternoon or evening or whatever it was. And yeah, I was actually in San Francisco when he died, which was maybe 7 or so years ago. And I went to his funeral. There were a lot of activists there. He definitely had like a lot of people that cared a lot about him. And he was also very active in the movement, the psychiatric survivor movement, which, you know, so since he would be in his 80s now, or maybe even 90s, he, you know, was in a different kind of wave of the psychiatric survivor movement, like the one that came before the internet, where it was very like I actually ended up getting some books that he had, and from when he died, his apartment was just full of books, you know, all kinds of books, but a lot of psychiatric survivor literature, some from like the older times. So I guess, like, you know, the movement for people who are labeled crazy to advocate for themselves and to not be treated, not to be abused or treated against their will or ostracized from society, has been going on for a long time. And he was one of the earlier people in the modern movement. So yeah, he had a bunch of magazines called Madness Network News, which were from probably the 60s or 70s. And I don't know if I'm going too much off on a tangent, yeah. But but yeah, it's like, it's interesting how there's this sort of lineage of psychiatric survivors that I think learn from each other. And, you know, when I sort of entered this community was almost 20 years ago now. So things were so different then than they are now. And the internet really had not taken hold at that time. So it felt almost more like kind of like an organic lineage where there are like elders who mentor younger people. And, you know, I met him at conferences also. So I would go to different conferences around the country, and a lot of them are still going on or would be if it weren't for COVID, but I haven't gone to any in a while. But when I first started on this journey, on this path, I went to quite a few of these conferences and got to meet a lot of the older people in the movement. And again, it was before the internet was anything like what it is now. So it was a lot of, like, you know, stories being passed from person to person, like in a very, what might now be considered very old school sort of way, which I think still happens to some degree. But now that the internet can spread stories and information to so many people so quickly, I think maybe we've even lost a little bit of that, or it's just not, doesn't feel as relevant as it used to somehow.
So you mentioned the Freedom Center. Like, when I moved here in 2002, I remember going to a yoga class at the Freedom Center organized. It was really great. It was super helpful for me. Yeah. What's going on with the Freedom Center? Is there a Freedom Center?
I don't think it really exists anymore. I also went to that yoga class and actually ended up teaching that yoga class for a while. Mm-hmm. But I had gone to it for quite a while, even before I taught it. And again, like, I feel like those times were so different than these times now, but something that did come out of that community, well, I should say, you know, I think that a lot of what's going on now might be more funded by the state, and some of it is still really good because it's coming out of a similar spirit and similar people and really being run by people who have gone through their own experiences and things like that. The Freedom Center definitely was not getting state money. I mean, we got grants and stuff, but the Freedom Center was, like, very grassroots, and I think, you know, like a lot of underfunded grassroots programs, there was also a lot of chaos, and, you know, it became probably unsustainable after a while. Also, a lot of the people that were involved with the Freedom Center that started it, or the organizers, ended up either moving away or getting other jobs or having kids, or just, like, things happened as people got older. And I think there might have been this sort of resurgence of the Freedom Center a number of years ago, where maybe there was a new group of people that started it up again. But I haven't really heard anything about it in a while, so I don't think it's still going on.
Do you know where Will Hall lives? I mean, he does the Madness Radio, but I don't know, like, where he's operating out of.
Yeah, I think he's in California now, though I'm not 100% sure. Yeah.
That's what I heard. If people are interested in your book, can you just give a little plug for the book?
Yeah, sure. So Freedom from Psychiatric Drugs, a manual and workbook for psychiatric survivors. You can find it on Amazon. It comes as an ebook or a print book. And if you check it out on Amazon, Freedom from Psychiatric Drugs by Haya Grossberg, you can see the reviews. Yeah, there are some really great reviews on there. You can also check on my website, hayagrossberg.com, to see more information about the book. I have some blogs about the book. Uh-huh. Yeah, and I just want to also thank you, Ruthie, for doing the interview. It's been really, really cool to talk to you about this topic.
Thanks, Drew. Yeah, thanks for coming out.
You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP 103.3 FM in Northampton, and streaming online at valleyfreeradio.org. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Stay tuned for Madness Radio coming up at 4 o'clock. Some announcements I'd like to make are that interview with Haya, that was from Sunday, July 12th. And then the previous interview that I played with John, that was actually from July 8th. And the music from Ben Ross that I played during Haya's interview, that was from his album Apocalypse Not Yet, which you can find at weatherbeard.com/Captain Shy. Today is Tuesday, which means the Northampton Farmers Market is going on downtown behind Thorne's Marketplace. I think that goes till 6:30 this evening. Tomorrow, Wednesday, you can catch the Florence Farmers Market from 2 until 6 in front of the Florence Civic Center by the Lilly Library. And what else is going on? Well, this Saturday, like pretty much every Saturday, there's the bike lab. The bike lab, learn to fix your bike or just hang out or borrow bike-specific tools or scrap parts. Or if you're looking for a bike, some kind of beater bike that I'm not going to ship to Trinidad that I have extra of, you can come by looking for beater bikes. Or if you want a bike, if you want to build up a bike, I can help you put bikes and parts together. That's Saturday, every Saturday from 11:30 until 2. Or if Saturday doesn't work for you, I'm happy to make appointments with people during the week. And you can find out that information and my contact information on the Pedal People website. Or you can just email me, Ruthie, R-U-T-H-Y, at pedalpeople.coop. Also, coming up this Saturday, July 18th, is a March for Black Trans Lives. And that is starting at 2 o'clock at Sheldon Field in Northampton. From 2 to 6 at Sheldon Field, Black Trans Lives Matter March. And I'm trying to decide if I should play the latest song from Ben Ross. He played it for us at potluck last night. I don't know if I should tell you what it's... Well, okay, so what he heard an interview with someone who was on the International Space Station, and it sort of prompted some of this song.
Subanella crop casparalius unicorna forest sear mirth shines in black radiance hovering round an ocean of constellations approaching International Space Station. Surreal is now real and we are all Earth emanations. Crophia subanella crop casporia corner forest sirma, thin blue line of separation, all life on earth fragile in manifestation, everything arising subject to fragmentation, realize in heart, body and mind we're Earth's creation. Subanella crop casporealis unicorna forest sirma to the International Space Station. The virus on Earth has spread across every nation. Continue with all scientific investigations. Crystallize proteins and activate translocations. Crophia subanella crab casporia. Unicorna forest sirma, Earth shines in black radiance, hovering round an ocean of constellations, leaving now the International Space Station. Surreal is now real, and we are all Earth emanating.
That was Ben Ross playing his new song in the backyard of 8 High Street last night here in Florence, Massachusetts. Thanks for listening to Out There Today on Valley Free Radio. Stay tuned for Madness Radio coming up at 4 o'clock. And enjoy the ride.
It makes me feel free.
I do it to save money.
I feel in charge when I'm doing it.
It's a healthy way of life.
Why do you bicycle instead of driving a car?
It's a good way to fit more exercise into my day.
Bicycling is a fun, healthy, economical, and fuel-efficient way to travel. Enjoy the ride. Take your bike. Brought to you by the Franklin Regional Council of Governments and Pioneer Valley Planning Commission, with funding provided by the Federal Highway Administration and Massachusetts Executive Office of Transportation. Come visit enjoythericebybike.com.
I'm Rachel Maddow with the Pioneer Valley Planning Commission and the Franklin Regional Council of Governments for Valley Free Radio, reminding you that legally, bicycles are vehicles, and bicyclists have the same rights and responsibilities and should observe the same rules as motorists. For more information on bicycle rights and safety, go to www.massbike.org.